but he couldn't see much out of the ordinary. Some smoke hung in the air above Reactor 4. Glukov had a cup of coffee and told his wife he would head to Kurchatov Street to meet the bus bringing the night shift back from the plant. They'd be able to tell him what was going on. He waited at the bus stop, but the men from the shift never arrived. Instead, a truck filled with policemen pulled up. Glukov asked what had happened. "It's not clear," the policeman said. "The wall of the reactor hall has collapsed." "What?" "The wall of the reactor hall has collapsed." It was an unbelievable idea, but Toptanov would surely have an explanation. "Perhaps I just missed the bus," Glukov thought. "Leonid might already be at home." It was less than a 15-minute walk from the bus stop to Toptanov's apartment building. Glukov climbed to the top floor, turned right at the head of the stairs, and walked to the door at the end of the hall, number 88, handsomely upholstered in red imitation leather. He pushed the buzzer. He pushed it again. There was no reply. The Pripyat Hospital, Medical Sanitary Center number 126, was a small complex of biscuit-colored buildings behind a low iron fence on the eastern edge of the city. It was well-equipped to serve the growing town and its young population, with more than 400 beds, 1,200 staff, and a large maternity ward. But it hadn't been set up to cope with a catastrophic radiation accident, and when the first ambulances began to pull up outside in the early hours of Saturday morning, the staff was quickly overwhelmed. It was the weekend, so it was hard to find doctors, and at first no one understood what they were dealing with. The uniformed young men being brought from the station had been fighting a fire and complained of headaches, dry throats, and dizziness. The faces of some were a terrible purple, others a deathly white. Soon, all of them were retching and vomiting, filling wash basins and buckets until they had emptied their stomachs, and even then unable to stop. The triage nurse began to cry. By 6 a.m., the director of the hospital had formally diagnosed radiation sickness and notified the Institute of Biophysics in Moscow. The men and women arriving from the plant were told to strip and surrender their personal effects, watches, money, party cards. It was all contaminated. Existing patients were sent home, some still in their pajamas, and the nurses broke open emergency packages designed for use in case of a radiation accident, containing drugs and disposable intravenous equipment. By morning, 90 patients had been admitted. Among them were the men from control room number 4, senior reactor control engineer Leonid Toptanov, shift foreman Alexander Akimov, and their dictatorial boss, deputy chief engineer Anatoly Dyatlov. At first, Dyatlov refused treatment and said he only wanted to sleep, but a nurse insisted on putting in an IV line, and he began to feel better. Others, too, seemed not to have been too badly injured. Alexander Yuvchenko felt dizzy and excited, but soon fell asleep, woken only when a nurse came to attach a drip. He recognized her as a neighbor from his apartment building and asked her to find his wife when she finished her shift to reassure her that he would be home soon. In the meantime, Yuvchenko and his friends tried to estimate how much radiation they had received. They thought 20 rem or perhaps 50. But one, a Navy veteran once involved in an accident on a nuclear submarine, spoke from experience. "You don't vomit at 50," he said. Vladimir Shashinok, rescued from the wreckage of Compartment 604 by his colleagues, had been one of the first to arrive. Burns and blisters covered his body, his ribcage was caved in, and his back appeared to be broken. And yet, as he was carried in, the nurse could see his lips moving. He was trying to speak. She leaned closer. "Get away from me. I'm from the reactor compartment," he said. The nurses cut the shreds of filthy clothing from his skin and found him a bed in intensive care, but there was little they could do. By 6 a.m., Shashinok was dead. It was not yet 8 o'clock when Natalia Yuvchenko heard her doorbell ring. She had awoken early, tired and anxious. Her son's cold had kept him awake and crying throughout the night, and the apprehension Natalia had felt the evening before only deepened. But the city schools, like those throughout the Soviet Union, had classes on Saturday morning, and she was due to begin teaching at 8:30. So she washed, dressed, and waited for Alexander to come back from the plant. As the night shift finished at 8, if he hurried to the bus, he'd make it home just in time to take over with Kirill before Natalia had to leave. But instead of her husband, a stranger was at the door, a woman whose face looked familiar but whom at first she couldn't place. It was a neighbor who worked at the hospital. Natalia, she said, your husband asked me to tell you that you shouldn't go to work. He's in the hospital. There's been an accident at the station. Around the corner, at home on Heroes of Stalingrad Street, Maria Protsenko heard a commotion in the apartment downstairs. Just as she did whenever she wanted to telegraph the neighbors below with important news or to share something on the stove that was particularly tasty, Protsenko rapped on the kitchen radiator with a spoon. The response came clanging right back, "Come down." Protsenko was a small but formidable 40-year-old who wore her dark, curly hair cropped sensibly short, born in China to Sino-Russian parents, yet forged in the crucible of the USSR. Her grandfather had been arrested and disappeared into the gulag during Stalin's purges. When she was a baby, both her older brothers died from diphtheria because they were kept from seeing a doctor by the curfew in the Chinese border town where they lived. After that, her grief-stricken father sank into opium addiction, and her mother fled into Soviet Kazakhstan, where she raised Maria alone. A graduate in architecture from the Institute of Roads and Transport in Ust-Kamenogorsk, Protsenko had been Pripyat's chief architect for 7 years, with her own office on the second floor of the city Ispolkom. It was from there that she oversaw the execution of Pripyat's new construction projects with a profoundly un-Soviet eye for detail. Barred from party membership by her Chinese birth, she brought an outsider's zeal to her work. She roamed the streets with a ruler, checking on the quality of the concrete paneling in new apartment buildings. She chastised the construction workers for shoddy sidewalks. Children will break their legs, and then how will you feel? When persuasion wouldn't work, she lashed them with invective. More than a few of the men were afraid of her. Many of Pripyat's apartments and major buildings, the Palace of Culture, the hotel, the Ispolkom itself, were erected from standardized blueprints produced in Moscow and designed to be reproduced identically in every town in every corner of the USSR. But Protsenko did what she could to make them unique. In spite of the prevailing state doctrine calling for gloomy proletarian aesthetics, rejecting decadent Western notions of individuality in the interests of economy, she wanted them to be beautiful. Protsenko worked frugally with small supplies of hardwood, ceramic tiles, or granite to decorate the interiors of Pripyat's public buildings, designing parquet flooring and wrought iron screens in a botanical pattern for the restaurant, or inlaying small sections of marble in the walls of the Palace of Culture. She watched as the city grew from just 2 micro-districts to 3, then 4. She helped choose the names of the new streets as they were added, and attended to the finer points of each of the city's new amenities. The library, the swimming pool, the shopping center, the sports stadium, all passed through her hands. As she left her apartment that morning, Protsenko was still expecting to spend the day at the office, busy with preparations for another expansion of the city. Only the day before, she had received a delegation from the Urban Design Institute in Kiev. Together, they were planning the infrastructure of Pripyat's 6th new district, to be constructed on reclaimed land beside the river, to accommodate the workers who would operate the first reactors of Director Bruhanov's massive new Chernobyl II plant. Dredging was underway, bringing up sand from the river bottom to provide the foundations of the extra neighborhoods. When they were complete, Pripyat would be home to as many as 200,000 people. By the time Protsenko made her way to the apartment downstairs, it was past 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. Her 15-year-old daughter had already left for school. Her husband, who worked as a mechanic for the city, was still asleep in bed. She found the neighbors, her close friend Svetlana and her husband Victor, sitting at their kitchen table. Despite the early hour, they were drinking shots of moonshine vodka, or samagon. Svetlana explained that her brother had called from the plant. There had been an explosion. "We are going to chase away the shatiki," Victor said, raising a glass. Like many construction and energy workers at the plant, he believed that radiation created contaminated particles in the blood, shatiki, against which vodka was a useful prophylactic. Just as Protsenko was telling him that she didn't think she could handle samagon, whatever the need, her own husband appeared in the doorway. "You've got a phone call." It was the secretary from the Ispolkom. "I'm coming over," Protsenko said. By 9 a.m., hundreds of members of the militia had been mobilized on the streets of Pripyat, and all roads into the town had been cut off by police roadblocks. But as the city's leaders, including Protsenko, Deputy Mayor Eselov, the Pripyat Civil Defense Chief, and the directors of schools and enterprises, gathered for an emergency meeting at the White House, Elsewhere in Pripyat, the day began exactly as it would on any warm Saturday morning. Across the city's five schools and in the Goldfish and Little Sunshine kindergartens, thousands of children started their lessons. Beneath the trees outside, mothers walked babies in their strollers. People took to the beach to sunbathe, fish, and swim in the river. In the grocery stores, shoppers stocked up on fresh produce, sausage, beer, and vodka for the May Day holiday. Others headed off to their dachas and vegetable gardens on the outskirts of the city. Outside the cafe beside the river jetty, last-minute preparations were underway for an alfresco party to celebrate a wedding, and at the stadium, the city soccer team was warming up for an afternoon match. Inside the fourth-floor conference hall of the White House, Vladimir Malamuche, the party's second secretary for the Kiev region, took the stage. Malamuche had arrived from Kiev just an hour or two earlier, and since the party took precedence over government in emergency situations, was now in charge. Beside him stood the two most powerful men in the city, plant director Viktor Bruhanov and construction boss Vasily Kitsima. "There has been an accident," Malamuche said, but offered no further information. "The conditions are being evaluated right now. When we know more details, we'll let you know." In the meantime, he explained, everything in Pripyat should carry on as usual. Children should stay at school, stores should remain open, the weddings planned that day should continue. Naturally, there were questions. Members of the Young Pioneers of School Number 3, 1,500 children in all, part of the communist equivalent of the Scouts, were due to assemble in the Palace of Culture that day. Could they proceed with the meeting? There was a children's health run scheduled for the following day through the streets of the city. Should that go ahead too? Malamuche assured the school director that there was no need for a change of plans. Everything should continue as normal. "And please do not panic," he said. "Under no circumstances should you panic." At 10:15 a.m., a solitary armored car, the lead radiation reconnaissance scout vehicle of the 427th Red Banner Mechanized Regiment of the Civil Defense Forces of the USSR, swung slowly left off the Kiev road toward Pripyat. Hatches sealed and dosimetry instruments on, its engine whined as it rose over the bridge across the railway line. The city came into view through the crew's thick bulletproof windows. Everything seemed normal. Trailing behind at a distance of 800 meters, as combat protocol required, the remaining vehicles of the reconnaissance column caught up with the scout car on the square outside the White House. The civil defense troops had been instructed to conduct a radiation survey of the city and its surroundings, but lacked any detailed maps of the plant or Pripyat. Up on the second floor of the White House, a detachment of men found Maria Protsenko, who had maps of the city but no means to copy them. As photocopiers could be used to create samizdat materials, access to the few in the USSR was controlled tightly by the KGB. Protsenko sat down at a drawing board and began turning out schematics of the city as quickly as she could by hand. At noon, as the radiation reconnaissance troops divided into groups and set off to take dosimetric readings across the city, an Mi-8 helicopter of the Soviet Armed Forces 225th Composite Air Squadron headed toward Pripyat from the south. In the pilot's seat was Captain Sergei Volodin, who, along with his two-man crew, had been on standby that morning at the military airport in Borispol. The duty was part of a regular rotation, which required one helicopter crew to be ready for emergencies anywhere in the Kiev military district. Volodin and his men were otherwise accustomed to the more comfortable task of ferrying Soviet dignitaries around the Republic. Their helicopter was specially modified for the purpose, its carpeted cabin furnished with comfortable armchairs, a toilet, and even a bar. Although they had received mandatory training to prepare them to fly combat missions in the mountains of Afghanistan, the call-up had never come. At around 9 that morning, Volodin had received orders to conduct an airborne radiation survey around the Chernobyl plant. On the way there, he was to collect a senior officer of the civil defense who would supply the necessary details. After filing his flight plan, Volodin went to the duty officer to collect personal dosimeters for himself and his crew. But the instrument's batteries were corroded. Only the squadron's chemical services officer could replace them, and he was on the other side of the airfield, building a garage for the base commander. Volodin decided he could do without personal dosimeters. And although he and his crew had been issued respirators and rubber chemical protection suits for the mission, flying in such an outfit seemed impossible. The weather was still warm, and it was hot inside the cockpit, even in their summer uniforms. At around 10 a.m., the flight engineer started the engines and Volodin set off in his shirt sleeves. He collected the civil defense officer, a major equipped with his own military radiation detection equipment, and continued toward Pripyat to gather further instructions. Volodin knew Chernobyl well. He often ferried the squadron's helicopters to the big military aircraft plant in Kaunas, Lithuania, for annual maintenance, and the trips would take him past the gleaming white boxes of the power station. Sometimes, just out of curiosity, he'd turn on the DP-3 battlefield radiometer installed behind his seat in the cockpit. Intended for use after a nuclear attack, the DP-3 could be adjusted across four ranges of sensitivity, measuring up the scale from 10 to 100, 250, and finally, 500 Rentgen an hour. But he'd never seen the needle even flicker. Now, as the pilot approached the station at a height of 200 meters, he could see white smoke drifting above the buildings. He told the engineer to turn on the cockpit radiometer. His navigator prepared to make the calculations necessary to estimate from their airborne readings what the radiation dosage might be on the ground. Volodin caught sight of a yellow Icarus bus driving between the incomplete 5th and 6th units of the power station. Well, he thought, if people are still at work down there, everything must be okay. Then he saw that the western end of the plant had collapsed. Inside, something was burning. 18 Rentgen an hour, the flight engineer reported, climbing rapidly. The civil defense major opened the door of the cockpit to report that his hand was radioactive. He'd opened a cabin window to take his own readings outside, 20 Rentgen an hour. Leaving the plant behind, Volodin prepared to set down the helicopter in Pripyat so that the major could gather detailed instructions for the survey flight. He circled the city to land against the wind. He noticed how many people were out on the streets, fishing on the riverbank, planting potatoes in their allotments. The sky was a clear blue, the forest a vivid green. A flock of white gulls wheeled overhead. Volodin brought down the Mi-8 near a playground on the southwestern edge of the city where he hoped to avoid creating too much disturbance. But the machine always attracted attention whenever it landed near civilians. It was quickly surrounded by a crowd of adults and children. The adults wanted to know what was going on at the station and how soon they'd be able to get back to work there. The children wanted to see inside the helicopter. While the civil defense major went into the city, Volodin allowed them in, six or seven at a time, to look around. Back at the plant, the staff summoned during the night by emergency telephone calls had been joined by members of the regular morning shift, who arrived for work as usual at 8 o'clock. At the construction headquarters, just 400 meters from Unit 4, the daily briefing began as it always did, but it was broken up by news of an accident at the plant, and everyone was sent home. Yet there was no great sense of alarm. Some construction workers took advantage of an unexpected day off, going to their dachas or swimming at the beach. There were mishaps all the time at the plant, and radiation had never seemed to hurt anyone. The last time something like this happened, trucks had appeared in Pripyat to spray the streets, and children had played barefoot in the decontaminant foam when they passed. From her desk at the White House, Maria Protsenko phoned home to tell her husband to vacuum and wash the floors of the apartment, and to make sure that when their 15-year-old daughter returned home from school, she changed her clothes and showered. Yet when she called back 2 hours later, she found them both unflustered by her warnings. They were watching a movie together on TV, and her daughter hadn't even bothered to wash. "When the movie finishes, I'll go," she said. Even those who had seen the developing catastrophe firsthand found it hard to reconcile the destruction at the plant with the carefree atmosphere on the streets of Pripyat. A manager working on the 5th and 6th units had seen the blaze for himself as he returned late at night by road from a trip to Minsk. Just an hour after the explosion, he stopped his car less than 100 meters from the shattered reactor hall of Unit 4 and watched, transfixed and terrified, as firemen on the roof struggled to contain the flames. Yet when he awoke at home in Pripyat at 10 the following morning, everything seemed so normal. He felt determined to enjoy the day with his family. Elsewhere, however, there were signs that not everything in the city was quite as it should be. The technician's next-door neighbor, an electrical assembly man, spurned the beach that morning in favor of the roof of his apartment building, where he lay down on a rubber mat to sunbathe. He stayed up there for a while and noticed that he began to tan right away. Almost immediately, his skin gave off a burning smell. At one point, he came down for a break, and his neighbor found him oddly excited and good-humored, as if he'd been drinking. When no one else seemed interested in joining him up on the roof, the man returned there alone and continued to work on his accelerated tan. But at the plant, the nuclear engineers on the morning shift recognized all too clearly the danger the city was facing and tried to warn their families. Some managed to reach them by telephone and told them to stay indoors. Knowing that the KGB was monitoring the calls, one tried to use coded language to prepare his wife to escape the city. Another persuaded Director Bruhanov to let him go home for lunch, and then packed his family into the car to take them to safety, only to be turned back at the end of Lenina Prospect by an armed militia officer manning a roadblock. The city had been sealed off. No one would be permitted to leave without official clearance. Arriving at Yanov Station at around 11 a.m., Benjamin Prianichnikov, the director of the plant's technical training programs, had missed all the drama of the preceding 12 hours. He'd been away on a business trip in Lvov. On his way home on the train that morning, he overheard other passengers discussing rumors of a major accident. Prianichnikov, an experienced nuclear physicist whose expertise had taken him from the plutonium factories of Krasnoyarsk 26 to the atomic testing grounds of Kazakhstan, had worked on the Chernobyl project at its inception and was proud of his position at the plant. He knew the reactors well and refused to believe the tittle-tattle. An explosion in the reactor core was impossible under any conditions he could imagine. He argued so vociferously with his fellow passengers that they almost came to blows. But when he arrived in Pripyat, he saw the tanker trucks of the 427th Mechanized Regiment of Civil Defense spraying the streets with a detergent that left a white foam in the gutters. The physicist recognized it as desorbent solution, designed to absorb and contain radionuclides when they settled on the ground. And there were militia officers everywhere. Prianichnikov ran back to his apartment to warn his wife and daughter, but found nobody home. From the apartment, he tried calling the station, but the line was dead. Taking to his bicycle, he found his wife a few kilometers outside of town at their dacha, tending her flowers. She refused to believe anything was amiss. Only when he showed her the dark specks of graphite on the leaves of her strawberry plants did she agree to return home. Prianichnikov suspected the accident was a catastrophic failure of the reactor, but without a dosimeter, he found it hard to convince his neighbors of such a heretical idea. He couldn't make them listen, and as someone whose father and grandfather had both died at the hands of the party, he knew that it could be dangerous to try too hard. When the civil defense major returned to Captain Volodin's helicopter, he brought news that the damage they'd seen at the plant had been caused by an explosion. A government commission was on its way from Moscow. When they arrived, they would need a full report on the current situation. The major said he would accompany Volodin and his men as they flew a triangular route around the city to locate areas of potentially high radioactive contamination. Before they took off again, Volodin told everyone nearby to take their children indoors and close the windows. At around 1:30 p.m., the pilot took the helicopter up to 100 meters, flew north over the first of three villages close to Pripyat, and then turned to the west. The cockpit dosimeter remained at zero. Volodin dropped to 50 meters and continued toward the next village. Nothing. He brought the helicopter down farther, to just 25 meters, but the needle of the radiometer didn't move. Volodin suspected that it just wasn't sensitive enough to get a reading. Passing the final turning point on the survey flight plan, Volodin began following the railway line in the direction of the Chernobyl plant itself. On his right, he could see the village of Chestogolova, where more people were tilling their gardens. The wind was now blowing southwest, carrying a thin trail of white smoke, or steam perhaps, from the direction of the plant and the railway station toward the village. Chestogolova wasn't part of the survey flight plan, but Volodin decided to take some readings anyway. What if the smoke was radioactive? This stuff could be falling right on people's heads. As he passed the railway station, he pulled the control yoke over. The helicopter banked right. Large beads of liquid began to form on the canopy. At first, Volodin thought it was rain, but then he noticed that it wasn't breaking over the glass like water. Instead, it was strange, heavy, and viscous. It flowed slowly, like jelly, and then evaporated, leaving a salty-looking residue. And the sky remained clear. He bent over the control panel and looked up. Directly above him, the same whitish smoke was blowing overhead, thin in some places, dense in others, almost like a cloud. Captain, it's maxed out, the flight engineer shouted. What's maxed out? The DP-3. The needle's stuck. Then switch to a higher range, Volodin said, and turned to check the dial himself. But the radiometer was already calibrated to its most extreme setting. The needle was glued to the far end of the range at 500 rentgen per hour, and Volodin knew that the device took its readings from a receiver in the back of his seat. It seemed impossible. The level of radiation inside the cockpit had risen to the worst expected in a nuclear war. Whatever it was, he had to get them away from the cloud immediately. Volodin threw the yoke forward. The nose of the helicopter dipped down and to the left. The treetops flashed beneath them, a smear of green. He pushed the machine to its maximum speed, away from the railway station and toward Pripyat. Then the cockpit door flew open, framing the terrified civil defense major, his own radiometer in his hand. "What have you done?" the officer screamed against the howl of the engines. "You've killed us all!" Natalia Yuvchenko had spent all morning trying to discover what had happened to her husband, Alexander. First, she'd gone downstairs to the public phone and called the hospital, but they wouldn't tell her anything. Then she heard that the KGB was there and no one was being allowed in. But she couldn't stay at home, knowing nothing, and Alexander wasn't the only one who hadn't returned from work as expected. Her close friend Masha came up from her apartment downstairs to say that her husband, who worked in Unit 3, hadn't come home either. So Natalia left her son Kirill in the care of a neighbor, and together the two women went from door to door, apartment to apartment, building to building, down the street and across the courtyards, running up one echoing concrete staircase and then another, ringing doorbells, searching for someone from the plant who could tell them what had happened. She tried to send a telegram to her parents, but the post office was closed. Masha picked up the phone to call her mother and father in Odessa, but the line had been cut off. Eventually, Masha's husband came home, apparently unhurt, but confirming news of an accident. He explained that he had helped get Alexander to the hospital before dawn that morning. Then another neighbor said that he had seen him in the hospital. He was all in one piece, and the neighbor knew where Natalia could find him, on the second or third floor at the back. She might not be able to get inside, but she could certainly call up to him through the window. It was already late in the afternoon when Natalia found her way to hospital number 126. Alexander appeared in the window, bare-chested, wearing pajama bottoms. He leaned out and asked his wife if she had left the windows of the apartment open the night before. Natalia was relieved. He looked normal and unhurt, although his arm and shoulder were bright red as if from an angry sunburn. And, more troublingly, the hair at his temples appeared to have turned completely white. "Of course," she replied. "It was so hot and stuffy." Behind her husband, Natalia could see other people moving around inside the hospital ward, more patients perhaps. She couldn't really tell. None of them came near the windows. She was terrified someone would notice her there and she'd be taken away. "Natasha," Alexander said, "close all the windows, throw away all the food that has been out, and wash everything in the apartment." He couldn't say much else. The KGB were there, interrogating everybody. But the couple agreed to meet the same way the following day. By now, other women had managed to smuggle vodka, cigarettes, and folk remedies to their husbands, some even passing them up through the hospital windows, tying bags to the end of a rope. Alexander said that there were a few things he'd like Natasha to bring him: a towel, a toothbrush, toothpaste, and something to read. These requests were the normal things anyone might want to have in the hospital. It seemed the panic was over. Natalia felt quite sure that now, as soon as whatever had gone wrong at the plant was resolved, everything would be okay. She went home and did everything just as her husband had said. At 4 p.m., the members of the OPAS medical team began to triage the patients. Alexander Esilov, deputy mayor of Pripyat, stood by as the doctor in charge produced a worn notebook and began reading a list of symptoms down the phone to someone at the Institute of Biophysics in Moscow. "Many are in grave condition," he said in a hollow voice. "The burns are bad, some have severe vomiting and a large number of burns on the extremities. The patient's condition is exacerbated by thermal burns. They should be urgently evacuated to Moscow." But when he explained that there were as many as 25 people in need of an emergency airlift, there were protests on the line. The specialist's voice turned harsh. "Well then, organize it," he said. Still more patients were arriving all the time, displaying the symptoms of radiation sickness. After some debate, the director of the hospital made the decision to distribute to everyone in Pripyat stable iodine, a prophylactic against iodine-131, the radioisotope that presents a particular threat to children. But there weren't enough iodine pills in the dispensary, and it was imperative that the crisis remain secret. So Esilov used his party contacts in the neighboring districts of Chernobyl and Polesia to quietly appeal for help. By nightfall, a total of 23,000 doses of potassium iodide had arrived, and preparations were underway to deliver them door-to-door to apartments across the city. At 8 p.m., Second Secretary Malamuche summoned Esilov back to the White House. The deputy mayor found the building surrounded by parked vehicles of all kinds, Volgas, Moskvitches, Militia Patrol and escort cars, military jeeps, and the new black sedans of senior party officials. Inside, on the third floor, a group of colonels and generals in uniform waited outside the office where the government commission was meeting. Malamuche instructed Esilov to transfer the most seriously injured patients from the Pripyat Hospital to Borispol Airport outside Kiev. From there, a military jet provided by General Ivanov, the civil defense chief, would fly them to Moscow. From the office window, Esilov could see a large crowd leaving an evening screening at the Prometheus Cinema and mothers strolling with their children toward the cafe on the pier. The sound of tinkling glasses drifted up from a wedding celebration in the restaurant below. He heard shouts of "Kiss!" and then, in slow chorus, "One, two, three." By nightfall on Saturday, the telephone lines and the hardwired radio speaker boxes in every apartment in Pripyat had fallen silent. The boxes, radio tochki, or radio points, hung on the walls of homes throughout the Soviet Union, piping in propaganda just like gas and electricity over three channels, all Union, Republic, and City. Broadcasts began every morning at 6 with the Soviet anthem and the cheerless greeting, "Govorit Moskva," Moscow speaking. Many people left the radio on constantly. At one time, switching it off was regarded with suspicion, a susurrating trickle of party enlightenment in every kitchen. When the boxes were silenced and the phones went dead, even those in Pripyat who had spent the afternoon soaking up the sunshine began to realize something unusual was happening. And then officials from local housing bureaus, or ZHECs, came around, telling people to mop their stairwells, and young women from the Komsomol began knocking on doors, handing out stable iodine tablets. Word spread that all the remaining reactors at the plant had been shut down. There were rumors of a citywide evacuation. Some people even packed their bags and went down into the street, expecting to be taken away at any minute. But no official word came. Alexander Karol had spent much of the morning sitting in Leonid Toptanov's apartment, waiting for his old friend to come home and explain what had happened inside Unit 4. He'd heard that there had been a maximum design basis accident at the plant, but he refused to believe it. Eventually, Toptanov's girlfriend, the nurse, arrived and explained that everybody from the midnight shift was in hospital number 126. Some of them were being flown to a special clinic in Moscow that evening. It was past 9 p.m. when Karol found his way to the hospital, clutching a towel, toothpaste, and Toptanov's toothbrush. When he got there, two red Icarus buses were drawn up at the front steps. One was being loaded with injured firemen and his friends from the night shift on Unit 4. They were all still wearing their hospital pajamas, and many appeared perfectly healthy. Karol climbed aboard and found Toptanov. Leonid looked just as he always did. But his friend could see that the seats and walls of the bus had been covered with sheets of plastic, and when Toptanov spoke, he seemed bewildered and disoriented. Karol asked him what had happened. "I don't know," the young operator said. "The rods came halfway and then stopped." Karol asked no more questions. He knew that few people in Pripyat would have any idea that the men were being taken from the city or where they were going. He began moving through the bus with a pen and paper, scribbling down the names and addresses of his friends' relatives, so at least he could tell them that their loved ones were being transported to Moscow. As he did so, two more men were brought aboard the bus on stretchers. One of them looked up. "Hi, Karol," he said brightly. But Karol had no idea who the stricken specialist was. His face had turned a bright red and was so swollen that he was completely unrecognizable. And when Karol saw the man on the second stretcher, his body seared by 30% burns, he realized that whatever had happened with the control rods This was no minor accident. By then, his time was up. His friends were leaving. Carol climbed down from the bus and watched as it pulled away from hospital number 126. That night, Carol and the other senior engineers from the plant gathered in groups in one another's homes, drinking beer and discussing what might have caused the accident. There were many theories, but no answers. They turned on the TV, hoping for some news, but there was no mention of the plant or an accident. In their big corner apartment at the end of Lenina Prospect, Valentina Bruhanov had waited in vain all day for news of her husband, whom she had last seen leaving silently before dawn. It was long after midnight when the station director returned home, bringing a permit that would allow their pregnant daughter and son-in-law to take the family car, slip through the Militia cordon, and escape the city. He stopped for only a few minutes. He said he had to get back to the plant. "You know the captain is always the last one off the ship. From now on," he told Valentina, "you'll be responsible for the family." When Veniamin Prianichnikov at last got through to his boss at the station by phone, he'd been told that they were conducting an exercise and he should mind his own business. That night, Prianichnikov shut his wife and daughter inside the apartment. He instructed them to pack their suitcases and be ready to leave town on the first train the next morning. The family was just preparing for bed when they heard strange sounds coming from the direction of the station. From their sixth-floor balcony, they watched as yellow and green flames flared 100 meters into the sky above the torn ruins of reactor number 4. In the small hours of Sunday morning, General Ivanov's plane lifted off from the tarmac at Borispol Airport, carrying 26 men suffering the initial symptoms of acute radiation syndrome. They included Leonid Toptanov, his shift foreman Alexander Akimov, Deputy Chief Engineer Dyatlov, Alexander Yuvchenko, and the firefighters who had fought the blazes on the roof of the reactor hall. Most had no idea where they were being taken or why. They worried about the fate of their families and about what had happened at the plant. The flight to Moscow took less than 2 hours. Those who were still conscious vomited all the way. As the new day began in the Militia station in Pripyat, where the Department of Internal Affairs had established an emergency headquarters, the duty officer recorded a series of notes in the official log. At 7:07 a.m., he wrote, "People are resting. At 8 a.m., the staff office will start working. The situation is normal. The radiation level is rising." 9. Sunday, April 27, Pripyat. The first of the big transport helicopters came in soon after dawn, dropping low over the rooftops surrounding the town square. The concrete facades of the White House and the apartment buildings on Kurchatov Street rang with engine noise from its twin turbines, the air whirled with dust, and rotor wash tore the petals from the flower beds. Major General Nikolai Antoshkin, the baby-faced 43-year-old chief of staff of the Soviet Air Defense Force's 17th Airborne Army, stood below, signaling to the pilot with his uniform cap until the machine came to rest in the street outside the Hotel Polesia. Dispatched from the central command post of the Kiev Military District the previous night, General Antoshkin had reached Pripyat by car after midnight on Saturday, accompanied by an Air Force chemical warfare expert. He had only the vaguest idea of what was happening at the power plant and had no instructions, staff, or equipment, not even the two-way radios needed to communicate directly with his pilots. As soon as he arrived in Pripyat, he went to the White House to report to Boris Shcherbina. The chairman of the government commission was brief. "We need helicopters," he said. Using a telephone in one of the offices now annexed by generals and admirals of the Army, Nuclear Navy, and Civil Defense, Antoshkin roused his deputy in Kiev from bed to scramble the heavy helicopter regiments. Flying by night in rain and low clouds and menaced by thunderstorms, the first machines came into the nearby military airbase in Chernikov from across Ukraine and Belarus. Antoshkin used the emergency powers granted to the government commission to summon test pilots from the helicopter training school at Torzhok, north of Moscow, and had more flyers transferred from bases 1,000 kilometers away on the border of Kazakhstan. By sunrise on Sunday, the general was in command of a disaster response aviation task force of 80 helicopters, awaiting orders at 4 different airfields around the plant, with more being redirected toward Chernobyl from airfields across the Soviet Union. He had also been awake for more than 24 hours. Inside the hotel, the din of the arriving aircraft shook Boris Shcherbina, Academician Legasov, and the other commission members from their beds. They had remained in session deep into the night, attempting to disentangle the tightening knot of problems surrounding the wreckage of Unit 4. The threat of a new chain reaction in the reactor, the fire, and the need to smother the invisible plume of radionuclides streaming into the atmosphere, but also the questions of whether to begin evacuating the city and how to solve the mystery of what had caused the accident in the first place. Legasov estimated that the reactor had contained 2,500 tons of graphite blocks, which had caught fire and already reached a temperature of more than 1,000 degrees centigrade. The intense heat could soon melt both the zirconium cladding of the fuel cassettes remaining in the core and the uranium dioxide pellets they contained, adding yet more radioactive particles to the cloud escaping from the shattered core. Legasov determined that the graphite would burn at a rate of around 1 ton an hour. Even accounting for the material that had been thrown from the core by the explosion, if his calculations were correct and what remained burned unchecked, the blaze could roar on for more than 2 months, releasing a column of radionuclides into the air that would spread contamination across the USSR and circle the globe for years to come. But the problem was one of unprecedented complexity. Ordinary firefighting techniques were useless. The graphite and nuclear fuel were burning at such high temperatures that neither water nor foam could possibly quench them. So hot that water would not only evaporate instantly into steam, further distributing radioactive aerosols in a cloud of toxic vapor, but also could separate into its constituent elements, oxygen and hydrogen, creating the possibility of a further explosion. And besides, the colossal fields of gamma radiation surrounding the reactor made it impossible to approach by land or water for prolonged periods. Legasov and the other increasingly exhausted nuclear specialists debated for hours, throwing out every idea they could think of, scavenging information from books and manuals and via phone and teletype from Moscow. Firefighting chiefs from the Ministry of the Interior and experts from the Energy Ministry sought help from their counterparts in the capital. One physicist, unable to find the answer to a simple question in the technical materials held at the power station, phoned his wife and asked her to look it up at home. In his office at the Kurchatov Institute, the 83-year-old director himself, Anatoly Alexandrov, chairman of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, holder of the patent on the RBMK reactor, and Legasov's mentor, sat beside a scrambler telephone offering advice to the scientists in Pripyat on how to regain control of reactor number 4. Legasov suggested covering it with the iron shot stockpiled at the plant's construction site for making radiation-resistant, heavy concrete. Shcherbina wanted to sail fireboats up the Pripyat and shoot water into the reactor hull with high-pressure hoses. But the iron shots sat in a warehouse that lay directly in the path of the fallout drifting from Unit 4 and was already too contaminated to approach. Pouring more water into the reactor would be dangerous and pointless. The arguments continued through the night. Meanwhile, the team from the Ministry of Energy's Nuclear Research Institute, Vinnyais, returned from their reconnaissance at the plant where they had witnessed the terrible light show blossoming from the ruins of Unit 4. They reported to Shcherbina that the radiation situation was perilous. At 2 a.m., Shcherbina telephoned his party boss in Moscow, Vladimir Dolgich, the Central Committee Secretary responsible for heavy industry and energy, and requested permission to abandon the city. By the time the scientists finally crawled into their beds in the hotel, a few hours before daybreak, Shcherbina had also reached a decision about the burning reactor, to smother it by bombarding it from the air using Antoshkin's helicopters. But the members of the government commission had still reached no conclusions about what combination of materials would work or how exactly such an operation might be accomplished. At around 7 a.m. on Sunday, Boris Shcherbina walked into the White House office now occupied by the Soviet Union's leading military authorities on radiation, General Boris Ivanov, Deputy Chief of Soviet Civil Defense Forces, and Colonel General Vladimir Pikolov, leader of the chemical warfare troops of the USSR. He announced himself ready to address the issue of evacuation. "I've made my decision," Shcherbina said. "What's your opinion?" Ivanov gave him the radiation report. Far from falling, as the Ministry of Health officials had hoped, the level of contamination on the streets of Pripyat was increasing. There was no question in the minds of the civil defense chief and his regional deputy, the population of the city was in danger not only from the radionuclides continuing to drift from the reactor, but also from the fallout already accumulated on the ground. They must be evacuated. The officer's view was backed up by a separate report from the director of Hospital No. 126. Only Pikhalov, the imposing, beetle-browed commander of the chemical troops, a decorated veteran of the Great Patriotic War, suggested that there was still no hurry to get the people of Pripyat to safety. Shcherbina told them that he had made up his mind. The evacuation should begin that afternoon. But he still held back from giving the order. First, he wanted to see reactor number 4 for himself. Soon after 8 a.m., still wearing the same business suits in which they had embarked from Moscow the day before, Shcherbina and Valery Legasov climbed aboard an Mi-8 helicopter parked in the middle of the city's soccer pitch. They were joined by Generals Pikhalov and Antoshkin, and two men from the Kiev prosecutor's office carrying a brand new video camera with which to record the scene. It was less than a 2-minute flight from Pripyat to the power station, and as the aircraft banked around the western end of the long turbine hall, the six men gazed through the circular portholes of the cabin at the dreadful spectacle below. To even the most recalcitrant Soviet eye, it was clear that Unit 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant would never again generate a single watt of electricity. In the crisp light of the new day, it was obvious that the reactor had been completely destroyed. The roof and upper walls of the reactor hall had gone, and inside, Legasov recognized the upper lid of the reactor, thrown aside by what must have been an enormous explosion, and resting at a steep angle on top of the vault. He could see graphite blocks and large pieces of the fuel assemblies scattered across the roof of the machine hall and on the ground beyond. A white pillar of vapor, most likely the product of the graphite fire, Legasov thought, floated from the crater, reaching several hundred meters into the sky. And ominously, deep within the dark ruins of the building, the scientist could see spots of deep crimson incandescence where something, he didn't know what, appeared to be burning fiercely. As the helicopter headed back to Pripyat, Legasov knew conclusively that he was not dealing with merely yet another regrettable failure of Soviet engineering, but also a disaster on a global scale, one that would affect the world for generations to come. And now it was up to him to contain it. At 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, a full 32 hours after the catastrophe had begun, Boris Shcherbina gathered the Soviet and local party staff in the Gorkom offices of the White House. At last, he gave the order to evacuate Pripyat. At 1:10 p.m., the Radio Tochki in kitchens across the city finally broke their silence. In a strident, confident voice, a young woman read aloud the announcement drafted that morning by a gaggle of senior officials and approved by Shcherbina. Attention. Attention, dear comrades. The City Council of People's Deputies would like to inform you that, due to an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the city of Pripyat, adverse radiation conditions are developing. Necessary measures are being taken by the party and Soviet organizations and the armed forces. However, in order to ensure complete safety for the people, and most importantly the children, conducting a temporary evacuation of city residents to nearby localities in the Kiev region has become necessary. We ask that you remain calm, be organized, and maintain order during this temporary evacuation. The emergency proclamation was worded carefully. It didn't tell the citizens how long they would endure their forced absence, but deliberately led them to believe it would be a short time. They were told to pack only their most important documents and enough clothing and food for 2 or 3 days. They should close their windows and turn off their gas and electricity. Municipal workers would remain behind to maintain city utilities and infrastructure. The empty homes would be guarded by police patrols. Some, fearing what would happen in their absence, packed only their most valuable possessions, party dresses, jewelry, flatware. Others packed winter clothes and prepared for the worst. Earlier that morning, Natalia Yuvchenko, carrying a towel, a toothbrush, and the other things her injured husband had asked her to bring to him, had returned expectantly to the grounds of Medical Sanitary Center No. 126. But when she reached the spot beneath the window where she and Alexander had talked the day before, she found no sign of him or any of the other men and women from the plant. The windows of the building stood open, but the entire wing of the hospital, which just a few hours earlier had been filled with patients, was now completely deserted. She looked around for someone to ask about where they might have gone, but found no one. When Yuvchenko got back to her apartment on Stroitaly Prospect, her neighbors told her about the announcement of a citywide evacuation. They would be gone for 3 days. Buses would be coming to collect everyone. Until then, keep all children inside. Wait. There was no time for fear or panic. There were too many questions to be answered. Where are my friends? Where will we be going? When will we return? Yuvchenko focused on immediate necessities. First, she had to make sure she had all of the family documents. She gathered their internal passports, their university diplomas, vaccination certificates, and the papers for the apartment. Then, where would she find the milk she needed to feed Kirill for 3 days? All of the shops were closed. Above all, she needed to find her husband. But it wasn't long before she discovered why Alexander had vanished so suddenly. Soon afterward, Sasha Karol, working through the list of addresses he had scribbled down on the bus the previous evening, arrived at her door and explained what he had witnessed of the medical airlift to Moscow. Unbidden, he had also brought Natalia money, 100 rubles, almost a month's salary, and a carton of milk for the baby. Setting down the milk on the seat of Alexander's bicycle in the hallway, she went into the bedroom to pack. She filled a small suitcase, clothes for the boy, a couple of dresses, some shoes, and went downstairs to wait. On the second floor of the White House, as military officers, scientists, and members of the government commission came and went, Maria Protsenko had remained at her desk throughout Saturday night. There was much to do and few people to do it. Most of the technical staff of the ISPALCOM had been sent home. Regardless of the crisis at the plant, Protsenko had felt determined to take care of the mountain of paperwork required for the planned development and expansion of the city. She remained confident it would proceed on schedule. Yet every hour the chemical troops of the civil defense kept returning and asked her to draw another set of maps as they continued to log the rising levels of radiation in Pripyat and beyond. And at 8 o'clock on Saturday evening, the mayor had told her to prepare the city for a possible evacuation. Nothing was confirmed yet, but if the order came, he said she should be ready to get the entire population of Pripyat out at short notice, by bus and by train. In the meeting room across the hall from her office, Protsenko joined a group of 20 members of the city administration to make the arrangements. The architect laid out the maps and counted every apartment building in the city, while the chiefs of the Internal Passport Department and the district execs added up the number of families in each complex and how many children and elderly each family included. Together with the city's head of civil defense, Protsenko then calculated the number of buses that would be needed to collect them all from each of the city's 6 micro-districts. In all, there were some 51,000 men, women, and children in Pripyat, of whom more than 4,000 were station operators and construction workers, expected to remain behind and take care of essential services in the city and work at the power plant itself. To get all the families out safely would require more than 1,000 buses, plus 2 river vessels and 3 diesel trains, which would be directed to Yanov Railway Station and used to ship out the single men who filled the city's dormitory complexes. At the same time, in Kiev, the Ukrainian Ministry of Transport began requisitioning buses from motor transport enterprises all over the city and the surrounding towns and suburbs, summoning their drivers to work late on Saturday night and preparing them to travel toward Pripyat under police escort. At 11:25 p.m., they received the Ukrainian Council of Ministers' order to move. By 3:50 a.m., 500 vehicles had already arrived at the city limits, with 500 more reaching Chernobyl town less than a half hour later. Before dawn, a column of vehicles some 12 kilometers long had halted on the road toward Pripyat, while the drivers awaited further instructions and ate from a mobile canteen. The entire operation was conducted beneath a blanket of secrecy. By mid-morning on Sunday, the bus stops of Kiev were crowded with frustrated passengers waiting in vain for scheduled services that would never show up. By lunchtime on Sunday, the citizens of Pripyat had begun to gather outside their buildings to await their departure from the city, clutching small shopping bags of belongings, supplies of food, boiled potatoes, bread, lard, and handfuls of documents. There was no sign of panic. Despite warnings to stay inside, parents found it hard to control young children, who ran around and played in the dusty streets. Some families set off on foot. At the same time, the crews of 2 helicopters of the 51st Guards Helicopter Regiment prepared to begin an airborne assault on Reactor No. 4. The operation, approved by Boris Sherbina at 8 that morning, began in a frenzy of improvisation. Not only takeoff and landing sites, but flight plans, speed, trajectory, radiation conditions, all had to be worked out by General Antoshkin and his men, and all were subject to the short-tempered demands of the chairman of the government commission. As the pilots began their reconnaissance sorties, establishing flight paths over the reactor, Sherbina's attention turned to locating the thousands of tons of material they intended to drop into it. Valery Legosov and the other scientists would eventually formulate a complex cocktail of substances to dump inside the ruins of Unit 4, including clay, lead, and dolomite, which they hoped would quench the graphite fire, cool the incandescent nuclear fuel, and block the release of further radionuclides into the atmosphere. Old man Alexandrov and the nuclear physicists of the Kurchatov Institute recommended the lead as well as the dolomite, a naturally occurring mineral containing calcium and magnesium carbonate. With its low melting point, the scientists believed that the lead would be liquefied in the heat of the blaze, helping to cool the temperature of the nuclear fuel and trapping radionuclides released from the ruined core. They also hoped that it would flow into the bottom of the reactor vessel, where it would solidify to form a barrier against gamma radiation. They intended the dolomite to cool the fuel and also to decompose chemically in the heat of the blaze, releasing carbon dioxide, which would deprive the graphite fire of oxygen. Alexandrov suggested adding clay, too, which might seal up the reactor and help absorb radionuclides. But none of these substances could be found at the power plant. Lead, in particular, was among the many raw materials in short supply throughout the USSR, and it was imperative that the operation begin at once. Sherbina instructed the pilots to begin bombing the reactor with powdered boron, the neutron moderator that would head off the possibility of further chain reactions in the remaining uranium, which had finally arrived by truck from the nuclear power plant in Rovno. Legosov had ridden out into the shadow of the reactor in an armored personnel carrier to take neutron radiation readings himself, and his data seemed to confirm that the chain reaction had now ceased amid the debris. But the physicists wanted to be certain it couldn't start again. In the meantime, Sherbina sent General Antoshkin and two deputy ministers of the USSR, both nuclear specialists, down to the bank of the Pripyat, where they personally began filling sacks with sand. Academician Legosov argued that sand would stifle the fire and create a filtering layer on top of the burning reactor to trap the escaping hot particles and radioactive gases. It was also cheap and plentiful. Maria Pratsenko's preparations to expand the city had already involved dredging the river for tons of it, which now lay piled on the bank beside the city's waterfront cafe, just 2 blocks from the square in front of the Hotel Polesia where the helicopters landed. This was just as well, as the quantities required were enormous. The scientists suggested that the reactor should be covered with a layer of absorbance at least a meter thick. According to their calculations, around 50,000 bags would do it. It was hot on the riverbank, and the general and the two ministers, still wearing their suits and city shoes, were soon bathed in sweat. And if the sun was bad, the radiation was worse. They had neither respirators nor dosimeters. One of the ministers sought help from the manager of a group of nuclear assembly specialists, who demanded that his men be paid a bonus for working in a contaminated area. But even with their help, the scale of the task was overwhelming. Two of the specialists drove over to a nearby collective farm, named Druzhba, or Friendship, where they found kolkhoz workers out in the fields, busy with spring sowing. The farm workers, relaxed and happy in the sunshine, didn't believe what they were told about the accident, the need to stifle the burning reactor, or that the soil they were tilling was already poisoned with radiation. Only after the farm director and party secretary arrived and repeated the explanation of the crisis again and again, did the workers agree to help. Eventually, between 100 and 150 men and women from the kolkhoz volunteered to join the effort on the riverbank, reinforced by troops from the Kiev Civil Defense Detachment. But Boris Sherbina remained implacable. Back inside the White House, he drove the ministers and generals to work harder and more quickly, and reserved a furious contempt for the representatives of the nuclear ministries. "They seemed to be gifted at blowing up reactors," he roared, "but pathetic at filling sandbags." If he was aware of the rising level of contamination in the air all around them, Sherbina didn't show it. The chairman seemed to regard the dangers of radiation with the haughty disdain of a cavalry officer striding across a battlefield bursting with cannon fire. and almost everyone else on the commission followed his lead. Mentioning the radioactivity surrounding them seemed almost tactless. Among the ministers, an air of Soviet bravado prevailed. At last, early on Sunday afternoon, the first 10 bags of sand, each weighing 60 kilos or more, were carried up to the square and loaded aboard one of General Antoshkin's helicopters.